Welcome to Money Matters TV. My name is Paul Mitchell. I'm a commercial banker. We're going to start the show with a question from one of our listeners, and then we'll switch to our featured guest, Robert Bavarnik, Esquire of Bavarnik & Associates. The question we have from Alan Thomas of Philadelphia is about college loans from banks. Are there any tips on how to save money? That's a good question. Part of the answer really is, in fact, most of the answer is probably about getting any kind of loan. A college loan has to be one of many purposes for a loan to an individual. Mortgages, home mortgages are some, buying a boat, buying a vacation home, even, taking an extended vacation are purposes for loans. So the first piece of advice, and it goes for almost any kind of transaction that's going to involve some kind of risk and some kind of expense, shop around. First place I would shop around is where you bank right now. Secondly, I would shop other banks in your area, and I wouldn't limit it to two or three banks. I would talk to maybe half a dozen banks. To the casual observer, banks are banks. They all look the same. Lawyers are lawyers. They all are the same. Realities are they're very different. They have their own niches. They have their own personalities. They specialize in certain things. They're good at things. It's the fit for your particular need and their involvement, how strong the bank is, their willingness to do certain types of loans. Some banks will say they're interested in college loans. Other banks will never mention it. You ask them, do you do college loans? Well, yeah, okay, what do you mean? Well, shop around. So that's number one. Now, in terms of minimizing expense in any loan, banks look at the risk. Risk has a couple of aspects to it. How much is a loan for? A $1,000 loan has a lot less risk than a $50,000 loan. $1,000 loan, most you can lose is $1,000. $50,000 loan, most you could lose is just about $50,000. So are you financing 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years at a time? Could have some major differences. So there's the risk part right there. Collateral is something also that's very important to banks. A second way of repayment. If your earnings, other source of income, is not sufficient to repay the bank in an orderly manner, will there be enough collateral to cover the balance? How liquid is the collateral? For example, if a bank has a mortgage on your home to secure a college loan, there's some states it takes almost 4 years for the bank to foreclose on that property in order to get its money back. That's not so good for most banks. They'd rather do it in 90 days or 180 days if they had to. So what type of collateral do you have? Second mortgage on your primary residence. That's pretty common for a college loan. It could be a mortgage or first or second mortgage on a vacation home. Not quite as good collateral. You don't live there all the time. And values could vary. Other types of collateral. How about stocks and bonds? You could borrow, pledge the collateral, the stocks and bonds to your bank, and get probably a pretty good rate on that loan. Minimum amount of fees, too. You talk about real estate collateral, you're going to have a lot more fees involved, maybe a point up front or some fraction of that, maybe some title insurance, maybe some appraisal costs, things like that. All adds up. So stocks and bonds. Even your savings account can be put in the form of a CD. Why do you want to do that? You could just cash it in. Well, maybe you don't. It's done all the time, whether it's for starting a business, for college education, for any purpose. And believe me, if the loan is cash secured by a CD issued by the bank that's holding that CD as collateral for its loan to you, the rate's going to be about as low as it can get. But again, shop around. Just because it looks and smells like the same type of loan, bank may treat it differently. They may have a different cost of funds involved because they have different capital levels, different policies, just different orientation, that type of a loan. Is that loan a constructive purpose? A four-year college education? Well, it's constructive for your child, perhaps, but in terms of, is the money going to be invested in something that's going to offer a return? Hopefully, your child gets a good job and will have enough money to repay it. But if you're talking about a regular bank loan, you borrow the money today, you start repaying it the next month, 30 days later, just as you would with a home improvement. So that's what you have to look for. Now, another aspect of it, and this goes into the shopping around, there may be certain banks that have an affinity with that particular college or university. You know, think about it. If you have 30,000 students in a certain community and there's a bank or a couple of banks that are serving that community, wouldn't they love to finance that bank to get some more business, to get more of its name out? Perhaps, and perhaps at a discount. Who knows? Ask, shop around. Just because one institution doesn't do it, or one college doesn't have such a program, doesn't mean the next one will. So that's what I would do. Now, if you're talking about that kind of affinity bank, it's probably going to be a local bank to the college or university. It's probably not going to be your hometown bank, unless your home happens to be in the same place as the college. So keep that in mind. But shop around, ask the college who they might recommend. You got to spread the word out and try to find out there. So there are some tips that in terms of getting a low-cost college loan. A lot has to do with financing any kind of business or any kind of purpose. And we're going to start talking about financing small businesses and what tips we could offer our listeners in that regard. And going right into that, before I go into that, I'd like to say if you do have a question on that you'd like to send into Money Matters, here's how you can do that.
You can have your questions answered on Money Matters. Please go to our website, money-matterstv.com. On our homepage, click on the banner on the right that says, Send Us Your Questions. While you're on our website, you can find information about our host and guests, as well as show notes and links about this show and past shows. Money Matters is also available as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, so you can listen to Money Matters while you're on the go. That website address, again, is money, M-O-N-E-Y, dash matters, M-A-T-T-E-R-S, TV.com.
Hello again. Our featured guest for the show is Robert Bavarnik, Esquire of Bavarnik & Associates. Bob, welcome to the show.
Paul, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Good to have you.
Good to have you.
So I was talking a little bit about business financing, dealing with a bank. I understand that you get involved in helping companies, helping individuals or other companies buy businesses.
Right.
And usually when you buy a business, somebody's going to finance some of it somehow, somewhere.
That is true. But before we get to that, I want to follow up on one thing that you were talking about in your wonderful answer on obtaining educational loans. And
yes,
this applies to any type of loan. And you're talking to the viewers about shopping around for various things. One of the things you want to shop around for are the terms. And in particular, you're also talking about if the loan goes south, your inability to pay, the bank is going to want to get their money back. And oftentimes, it takes them a long time from the commencement of the lawsuit till they finally get to the end. What a lot of loan documents have that's fairly unique to Pennsylvania, I'm not sure if it's in many other states, is something called a confession of judgment clause.
Yeah.
Looks like you've run across that. You probably had one or two of them in your role as a lender. But for the viewers, the way it works is really simple. So normally, if I enter into an agreement with you, Paul, and you owe me money and you don't pay me, I start litigation. And the way that works is I file a complaint. Then you answer the complaint.
I say that you didn't pay the loan according to terms.
We then go through this fact-finding process called discovery. At the end of discovery, there's a trial. And the trial judge will rule that you owe me the money or that you don't owe me the money. What a confession of judgment clause does is it puts that scenario on its head. You start at the end.
Yes.
So in other words, you've agreed that the bank can start by filing the judgment. Mm-hmm. Now, you as the borrower have the opportunity to try to knock out that judgment or to open it, and that's the totally knocking out of it called striking the judgment is a little bit difficult to do. Opening it's a little bit easier, but the fact is that it's much easier from the borrower to go through the four-year process rather than starting at the end. Okay. So for the viewers, again, when you're looking at the various types of loans, see if that confession of judgment clause is there, and you'll know. One of the things that the law requires is that it be there big, bold letters. You're supposed to initial
okay.
Because it does go against what the normal procedure is. And so that's one of the good things. If you have a number of potential lenders, mm-hmm. and they want your business, so you go to lender C, and you say, well, I'll go with you guys, but you know, I'm prepared to go to lender B. I'll go with you guys if you knock out the confession of judgment clause. Yep. Use that as your leverage. Yeah. So.
It varies from state to state. Some states just don't even allow it.
Most states don't allow it. Pennsylvania does allow it, and so that's somewhat interesting. The other thing that you were talking about, and we'll get to the question you asked in just a moment, but again, shopping around.
Yes.
That not only applies to loans, but it also applies to lawyers. Now, you said early on in your answer, lawyers are the same. You know, all lawyers are the same.
People have the sense. People think that.
And you almost lost your guest. I almost walked out, but I said, no, I'm going to stick around. But one of the things that's really important is to shop for a lawyer, because there are a lot of lawyers. And
yes.
One of the things that's great these days is with the internet. But if you're going to look for a lawyer, you want to hire the right person to do the right job. I mean, for example, I'm a business lawyer. I would not want somebody to come to me for a family law issue, estate planning. Somebody in my office does estate mm-hmm. planning. So if I get a call for estate planning, I will say, let me ship you over to the person in my office. I personally don't do that, but certainly you want to make sure that whoever you're going to hire has the experience in what they've done. And then once you find the person, and you want to talk to a lot of people, because the important thing is that you have a good relationship.
What's a lot? 3, 6, 10?
Well, if they're going to talk to me, then one. But setting that aside, if somebody calls me for something that's out of my area of core competency, I will give three names.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I always say, and these may be totally random calls of people I've never spoken with before. I always say, call these three people, and if you're unhappy with all three of them, please call me back, and I'll give you more names.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really important that a client have a good relationship with the lawyer. I think that a lot of people find that lawyers can be very intimidating, mm-hmm. and you've got to have the good
personality. Just like I mentioned, different banks have different personalities, believe it or not.
Oh, it's very true. It's very true. Well, it's part of that is, I think different banks have different personalities, but more importantly, different bankers
have different
personalities.
Sure.
I know that it's interesting. I've dealt with banks from the very largest to the very smallest, and I find that, and you can answer this better than I, having been through a number of banks, where I find that the larger banks are usually a little more hamstrung. They don't have the flexibility mm-hmm. that a lot of the smaller banks have. I have a client that's been using a small bank for years and years for his business, and he's had his ups and he's had his downs. So when he's in his down times, the bank is very willing to work with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that's
doesn't go to the office in San Diego or something like that.
That
handles those loans that are having a little difficulty.
That's right. Having said that, there are some of the very largest banks where you end up with a different person each time you call.
Yeah.
And it's somewhere far away. It may be in Iowa, it may be in Texas, or wherever it may be. And it's somewhat similar to lawyers. I used to be at a big firm. I'm at a small firm now.
Mm-hmm.
And my view has always been, go to the big firm for those types of matters that only the big firm can handle. Now, regulatory work, things that are really, really specific and very complex. But if you're talking about, and I don't want to really necessarily say run-of-the-mill, but more generic transactions, more generic litigation, then if you're comfortable with the smaller shop, you're going to get better rate structure, mm-hmm. and you will hopefully get better service, and you know who you'll be dealing with. I mean, in my firm, if you're working with me, you're working with a very small group of people. When I was at the larger firm and I would be on a large case and a client would make a call, they might be dealing with me or they might be dealing with any one of a number of mm-hmm. people. And the challenge there is, from the client's perspective, you sit there and you feel like you're having to explain things again and again and again. And so that's something that's not preferable, because you're a client. You want to feel that your matter is important and that the lawyer cares about you and your particular matter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good advice. So I was talking earlier about small businesses, they create jobs, that type of thing, and the community should really, you know, support local business, small businesses, and even, you know, get involved and see if they can help disabled people, you know, get jobs and that type of thing. A lot of businesses are sold, and you know, there's a lot of talk about baby boomers, you know, we're getting their retirement age, so all the businesses they've had are going to be sold, and it's going to be, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of transactions, businesses being sold. How would you advise somebody to go about arranging the purchase of a business? Maybe let's talk an example. Perhaps it's a $10 million revenues, I'll say technology business. You know, it's not making widgets, not making screws or door handles. It's technology. Company's been around for a while, so I'm interested in buying it. I go to the bank, and the bank says, "Well, what are you going to put down, and that type of thing, and how are you going to structure it?" And they go, "I don't know. I haven't thought of those things." And I get directed to, "You're the third person that list that the bank gives me." So I'm talking to you, Bob. So I have a business I want to buy. The bank's asking me about structure. What are they talking about?
All right, let's talk about a few things. We'll talk about, on a macro level, asset purchase agreement versus a stock purchase. And almost every single time, the asset purchase is better than the stock purchase. And we'll get to why in a moment. But before we even get to that, we're going to pre-agree. In other words, before we enter into this 50-page agreement, we're going to.
The buyer and the seller. Right. Okay. You're the third person.
I'm the lawyer, right, representing. It doesn't matter. Right. I'm representing the buyer in this particular instance. The first thing I want to do is enter into something called a letter of intent or a memorandum of understanding, and you could look at it as an agreement to agree. And what it does, it's a few pages long, sometimes it's even longer, and it sets forth the basic terms of the deal. It says, I'm going to buy all of the assets of ABC Company for whatever the number is. And but among the other things that you want to do is you want to make sure that you've got the time to do two types of due diligence. You want to do.
No, this is something that, this is a four-page agreement, something that you would have maybe a template for or something?
Like so many things in the law, I do have, because I've done so many of them, I have a template, and obviously I will change it for the specific arrangement. I did a deal a number of years ago buying a company that was in the entertainment business. And so one of the things that the client needed to do, they did financial due diligence and operational due diligence. The financial due diligence is obviously looking into the numbers. You get the accountants to go in there and crunch the numbers to make sure that what the seller is saying is really true. Once you get that done, the next thing you want to do is you want to do the operational due diligence. And in that particular situation, you want to look at the contracts with the performers. You want to look at the leases.
What if I'm buying a company that has $1 million in revenues? Am I going to spend money? I mean, I'm going to buy it for $200,000. How much money can I spend on this stuff?
Well, it's
getting all these professionals involved. Big company, you know, $10 million revenues, I can see that, but a little guy?
All right, so you raise a really, really good question that sort of reverts back to almost to the shop around concept, and that's hiring the lawyer. All right, so when you go to hire a lawyer, the last thing you want to do is say, I've got a company that does $1 million in business, I want to pay $200,000, go at it, here's a blank check. Spend as much time and as much money as you want. You give that to the lawyer, you're probably going to spend $250,000 in addition to the $200,000 you're going to spend to buy it. So what you need to do is you need to be a savvy consumer. You need to sit there and say, look, how are we going to do this? There are a number of ways that a lawyer can be hired. You can hire a lawyer on a flat fee, on an hourly basis, or in litigation on a contingency or percentage fee. Obviously, when you're doing a transaction, you can't do the contingency. Okay. So if you come to me to buy the company, you will ask me, will I do it for a flat fee for $10,000, $20,000, whatever the number is. And most likely I would say no, only because at this early stage, I don't know how much work would be involved.
Right.
Now that doesn't preclude me from doing that subsequently. So what I would recommend we do is let's do it in stages. Mm-hmm. So what you're going to do is you hire me for the limited purpose of doing the letter of intent. Mm-hmm. You're hiring me to assist with the due diligence, because if you're dissatisfied with the due diligence, mm-hmm. then it doesn't make any sense to
and
go into an agreement.
And I get a feel of how you operate and how we can work together before we get into the
right. That's exactly
I like that.
And one of the things that you as the client need to remember is that you control the relationship, right? As long as you do what you're supposed to do and pay me my bills, assuming that they're fair and reasonable, if you are dissatisfied with me, fire me. Mm-hmm. You're not required to stick with me. Now, obviously, one of the challenges you have, if I'm your lawyer for a certain period of time and you spent X dollars with me and you're sitting there and saying, yeah, I think Rob is inefficient, he's too expensive, whatever, he's just not getting me, whatever the case may be, part of your analysis is going to be, yeah, but if I go to somebody else, I have to pay to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
So if I'm lawyer two and you come to me and you say that, and I'll say, you know, I'm really sorry, but you do need to spend a little bit of time so that I can get up to speed on this.
Yeah.
And so, again, but you need to figure that out. One of the other things that I do as a lawyer is I'm always looking this as a long game. So you come to me as a client, I'm looking to do two things. One, I am looking to provide the best service I can for you most efficiently. Why? One, because that's my job, and two, because I want to turn you into what I refer to as my unpaid sales staff,
mm-hmm.
right? If you're satisfied with the services that I have provided, then you may become a recurring client, or more likely, you have friends, neighbors, and colleagues that you would be happy to talk to them and refer their matters to me when the time is appropriate. So it makes perfect sense for me to be efficient both with my time and with the amount I'm charging you,
mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to have it just be a one-off situation. And also, if you're buying a business, the other thing is I'd like to continue to represent you as the owner of the new business.
Mm-hmm.
And if all I do is I, in your perception, overcharge you for the preparation of the documents to buy the business, you're going to grit your teeth, you're going to pay me, you're going to thank me, and you're going to hire somebody else going forward. And frankly, I'd rather have you for years rather than months.
Right, right. Well, good. That's good. Very good explanation. Appreciate that. So let's get back to buy the business. And let's say it is a $10 million business, so it's serious stuff. You know, you're going to spend some money to do the due diligence. It's a little complicated. But it's a $10 million business, and it's making $1 million a year. You know, that's an attractive business. Okay?
Right.
So get back to, you said probably an asset purchase.
Absolutely.
Could be a stock purchase.
What you want to do is you're interested in buying the assets, the good stuff, and not buying the liabilities, the bad stuff. All right, so if you buy the stock of a company, you're getting both the kit and the caboodle. All right, so you're getting the assets and the liabilities.
And the unknown liabilities.
So if you are doing an asset purchase agreement, it'll be spelled out exactly what you are buying and what you're not buying. So it'll specifically say the assets and what's excluded. Go ahead.
But the seller wants to do the stock sale, I think, for tax purposes. Is that usually correct?
Yeah, he may want to do that,
yeah.
and that's fine. So you can go down the street.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not going to do a stock. I can't remember the last time I did a stock deal, because you just don't know what the risks are.
We have all these indemnities, and you put stuff in escrow and deposits here and all this stuff.
This happens
in 3 years. And
tell you what, I'm not a huge fan of the indemnity agreement, which an indemnity agreement is something goes wrong, you're going to reimburse me for what the damage that I incurred. All right. But that's only as good enough as the paper it's written on.
Yeah.
There's got to be something backing that up. Right, so if there's no fund there, then what do you do? And you're saying you could have holdbacks. What you could do is if the purchase price is, let's just say $500,000, that you could sit there and say, no, Mr. Seller, you're going to hold $100,000 for the next year, and then you can take $50,000 out of that after that,
yeah.
And then I'm on my own. And that's one way to do it. But again, I prefer to just go through the straight asset purchase agreement. You know, and you can even get more protection if the company is looking to sell. Another thought is the company, the selling company, can go into bankruptcy,
mm-hmm.
and you buy it out of bankruptcy under what's called Section 363 of the Bankruptcy Code.
Kind of prearranged.
And right, there are a number of ways to go about that. But the nice thing about that is you're purchasing the asset, and it's the phraseology is free and clear of claims, liens, and encumbrances. Now you have a federal court order saying you own the assets, you don't have the liabilities. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's owed money, they collect off of the money that you paid. Now, the downside, from your perspective as the buyer, is that it's subject to what's called higher and better bids. So if company ABC and you want to do a deal and they go into bankruptcy and you do this asset purchase agreement in bankruptcy, they are required by law to advertise it to see if anybody else wants to come in and buy it. And the reason for that is the goal in bankruptcy is to maximize the return to the unsecured creditors. Now, one way around that is you strike that deal ahead of time and you do it through what's called a plan of reorganization, which is sort of the end game of a bankruptcy. So there's that thought, which is to go through a bankruptcy, which does give you additional protections, but like anything else, positives and negatives with everything. Yeah. So there's additional protections and additional risks.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend a customer to buy a company out of bankruptcy unless they could immediately do something with it. That is, they had an existing company that could take those assets and employ those assets in their existing business. Because to restart something that's going the wrong direction, huge.
Well, you're talking about two different things. If it's an operating company that's going in, all right, then you can keep it operating and you buy it out of bankruptcy as opposed to, because you're absolutely right. A company that has stopped operating is going to be very difficult to restart. Yeah, yeah. So I wouldn't advise buying a carcass.
Yeah, and I've been involved in such a situation about 10 years ago. And like one of the business was a manufacturing company and it was inactive for about a year after the previous owner had stopped operating it. And it made molded parts. And what the buyer didn't know, and everybody was focusing on doing this deal to buy it. It took like 6-9 months to put it together, is that during that time, some of the customers were taking their molds out of the factory and therefore taking them to another factory to have their product made. And therefore the former customers didn't need that factory. But the focus was on the wrong thing at the wrong time and it was a shambles.
it's interesting because one of the things that you would put in an asset purchase agreement, then we're outside of bankruptcy now, this is back in the real world, where you as the buyer insist that the seller continue normal operations. And the other thing that you want to do is are there particular key employees that you want to keep?
Right.
One of the things that you need to be careful of if you're buying a company out of bankruptcy, if you're doing an asset purchase agreement, is you don't want to have something that's called successor liability or alter ego, because otherwise the liabilities follow the purchase of the assets, and there are the cases are clear as to what there is, what you look at, what you don't look at. I recently had a case where I was representing a creditor of a company that was sold, and we wanted to go after the purchasing company on a successor liability theory, and to the buying lawyer's credit, they did a great job drafting the contract. I looked at it and I said to my client, we could litigate it, but the likelihood is that we would lose that. Mm-hmm. But that's something that becomes very important if you're buying the assets, is to make sure that you're not going to be running afoul of successor liability.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like somebody that's going to buy a business really needs to engage in a very experienced attorney that not only knows the law well, but has seen an awful lot, lived through the war stories the whole bit. So it sounds like you fit that category, Rob. Right, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
That concludes our show. Our next guest for our next show will be Dr. Heather Steinman of the Wistar Institute. So thank you for watching Money Matters, because your money matters.